Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Thursday, April 29th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Scott, reading for Stephen Humphreys.
And I'm Molly Jackson.
Should colleges teach the classics? To some, the Greek and Roman canon is for elitists, whose idea of small talk at Yale dinner parties is to quote Pliny, the Younger, in Latin. But for Dr. Anika Prather, these ancient works are vital to understanding Black history. That's why she's dismayed that Howard University, where she's an adjunct professor, is dissolving the classics department and dispersing some of its courses to other divisions. The historically Black university says it's resetting priorities as student demand for the classics dwindles. At the same time, some worry that the texts are an intellectual bulwark for white supremacy. But Dr. Prather says the issue is not classics. The issue is how people teach them. Her course at Howard, Blacks in Classical Studies, reveals that diversity was always in the original texts, from Terence, the Roman African playwright, to the multicultural influence of Ethiopians and Egyptians on Plutarch and Herodotus. Her course also traces how the classics influenced Frederick Douglass, Anna J. Cooper, Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Angela Davis. Any ethnic group can claim that the classics are all about them, she adds, but then they miss the broader view. The classics encompass all of us. The search for beauty, truth, and virtue isn't elitist. It's universal. When Black Panther Party co-founder Huey P. Newton read Plato's Allegory of the Cave, it made him want to free Black people, Dr. Prather says. But then she goes even further. We all need to be set free, she says. White people, Black people. I want us all to come out of our caves and to look at each other in the light and to see our common humanity. Now, today's stories. Our first story. So far, President Biden has followed through on a number of campaign promises, particularly on the pandemic. But he's gotten relatively few bills through Congress, and the path ahead is likely to grow tougher.
Joe Biden vowed that, in his first 100 days as president, controlling the COVID-19 pandemic would be a top priority. As he passes that marker on Thursday, the United States seems on the verge of doing so, following the government's efforts to tamp down infection rates while pushing mass vaccination. Congress passed Mr. Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill in March, sending direct payments to voters while extending unemployment aid and a moratorium on evictions. The president has also fulfilled promises to reverse a number of former President Donald Trump's executive actions, including rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement and ending the travel ban on a number of majority Muslim countries. Whether Mr. Biden can push through ambitious items, such as his massive infrastructure bill, remains to be seen. His immigration policy is in turmoil, as a surge of unauthorized migrants has swamped the border. But Mr. Biden's first 100 days have signaled his vision for his time in office, centered on his belief that the federal government has an active role to play in Americans' lives. His belief in government is going to continue to be an essential part of what the Biden administration is all about, says Julian Zelizer, a political history professor at Princeton University. This story was reported by Story Hinckley in Washington for The Monitor.
Contrary to popular myth, gun owners aren't a monolithic group with views that closely mirror those of the NRA. In some suburban areas, diverse firearm owners are seeking solutions to gun violence, from personal responsibility to some regulation.
Jeff Kelman grew up in a progressive Massachusetts home, the son of two mothers. He had no idea people could even own guns until he was in middle school. But in high school, he started shooting for sport and developed a sharp eye. As a Jewish man whose wife is Chinese American, he is keenly aware of racial discrimination and the potential for that to turn into violence. So he carries a gun for self-defense. Like other suburban gun owners, he is open to at least some regulation, particularly focused on gun safety. In 2020, the United States saw the largest number of gun-related deaths, 19,000, in almost two decades. This spring has also seen a resurgence of mass shootings, defined as four or more people killed, which had paused during pandemic lockdowns. In response, the Democratic-led House passed legislation that would require background checks for all gun buyers and extend the time the FBI has to conduct those checks. A majority of gun owners support both ideas. The bill's future in a 50-50 Senate is uncertain at best. Whether the engagement of suburban gun owners like Mr. Kelman is enough to break gridlock in Washington is far from certain. Guns, after all, are deeply embedded in America's polarized identity politics. This story was reported by Patrick Johnson and Noah Robertson in Atlanta, Georgia, and Alexandria, Virginia, for The Monitor.
In negotiations with Islamists in West Africa, a prerequisite to ceasefires may be to establish trust. Some who advocate local talks see signs of hope. But can such talks really serve justice?
The Sahel is awash in jihadi insurgencies. From Nigeria to Mali, the stakes are high. About 1 million people have been displaced by conflict in Burkina Faso alone, where hundreds of people have died. But is negotiating with militants part of the answer, or a serious misstep? A short-lived truce in Burkina Faso and a handful of other local talks highlight a debate about whether government officials or local leaders should pursue talks for peace. In Burkina Faso, some critics firmly oppose negotiations on principle, including Albert Ouédraogo, a former minister of education. The government's line is to refuse any dialogue with those who sow death. I stick to this posture, he writes over a WhatsApp interview. Who will compensate the victims and punish those who have sown terror? Others say dialogue could sow seeds of stability across the region. Boubacar Ba, of the Bamako-based Analysis Center on Governance and Security in the Sahel, harbors hope. He saw for himself how much a negotiated peace meant to Malian locals, even if no one was held to account for the violence perpetrated. They also recognize that the road to peace is long and difficult, he says. It is a beginning, and we must believe in it. This story was reported by Shola Lawal in Lagos, Nigeria, for The Monitor.
Blaming crimes on racial groups can sow divisive distrust and fear. Some Asians and Blacks are working together to protest hate crimes.
After the recent mass shootings in Atlanta, in which six women of Asian descent were killed, communities of color are mobilizing together to battle racism. The fact that so many Blacks and Hispanics marched in solidarity with Asian groups is a positive indication that minorities see injustice against one group as injustice against all, says Earl Afari Hutchinson, author of Why Black Lives Do Matter. Yet he wonders whether that cross-activism will go beyond policing and anti-racism. Will that unity translate into unity on such issues as voter suppression, housing, jobs and education, and health disparities, he asks? Some young activists believe it will. Emma Tang, a Taiwanese-American student at New York University, calls this moment the birth of a fresh, new, powerful coalition. Since being attacked in what her friends call a hate crime, she appreciates the support of other racial groups more than ever. At a recent protest, she witnessed a diverse crowd fighting for Asian women. It makes me feel safe knowing that there are people looking out for us, she says. Stop Asian Hate would not be around today without Black Lives Matter, she adds. We need one another to advance our liberation. This story was reported by Nuralain Khawaja in New York for The Monitor.
Limbo is a movie about a Syrian refugee on a remote Scottish island that's battered by near-constant gale. The last time wind played such a role in a movie was Twister. Stephen Humphreys interviewed the director about how this story of identity loss is relevant to all of us.
On Friday, a new addition to films depicting refugees, Limbo, opens in theaters. Writer-director Ben Sherrick's movie features a young Syrian, Omar, who lives in Scotland with other refugees while they wait years for their asylum claims to be processed. The character's journey is one of rediscovering his true self. Mr. Sherrick, who is Scottish and briefly lived in Damascus just prior to Syria's civil war, researched the movie by collaborating with organizations Refugee and REACT, Refugee Action Scotland. He explains in an interview that he set out to do something unconventional by Hollywood standards, putting the refugees front and center, but also to address a universal theme. Everyone changes their identity across the course of their lives in one way or another, just even from losing a job or retiring, he says. There's a universality in Omar's journey to coming to terms with his circumstances and with his identity, and then also with his ambitions and his hopes for the future. This story was reported by Stephen Humphreys for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on innovation. In his first speech to Congress, President Joe Biden spoke of America dreaming again, discovering again. That shift is the basis of his proposals for a post-pandemic national renewal, starting with climate technologies. Folks, there's no reason American workers can't lead the world in the production of electric vehicles and batteries, he cited as one example. As more people come out of the pandemic shell of isolation and anxiety, will they be more curious, more inventive? Certainly, companies are rethinking the dynamics of work and the workplace. Schools have been forced to design new ways of learning. Now more than ever, curiosity matters, writes F.H. Buckley, a George Mason University professor, in a new book, Curiosity and Its 12 Rules for Life. As the U.S. Patent Office notes, its award system is designed to find success stories that will inspire others to harness innovation for human progress. The uses of adversity may be sweet, as Shakespeare said, but adversity can also liberate thought to see infinite possibilities. That's our news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. You've reached the end of today's edition, but we'll be back with more tomorrow, including a different kind of travel story. A former dairy farmer shares how country walks in Switzerland during the pandemic taught her to live in the here and now. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares that sometimes circumstances may seem bleak, but the ever-active light of Christ is here to inspire, rejuvenate, and heal. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Ibrahim Onofeko, and Jingnong Peng.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.